Welcome to episode 9 of season 2 of the Ubuntu UK podcast. It's Monday, the 20th of July, 2009, and in this episode, we're going to look again at laptop security, really sort of cover what we did before and expand a bit on that. We'll do the usual news and events. I'm going to do my command line foo bit, then we're going to talk to Dustin Kirkland about some of the stuff that he's doing. We'll give you the results of our competition for the Arduino and the book. We'll do our good old Ecosphere, Gerald, Phyllis. A ton of feedback, as we always do. So, chaps, what have you been up to in the last 2 weeks? Davey, go on, break the ice, mate.
Why did you pick on me first, eh?
Because you're that kind of guy.
Okay. What have I been doing? Yes. I've been doing some packaging this week, yeah?
And you're moving house.
No, you know what we install on our desktops and servers and such. I was trying to actually install something. Yeah, I was trying to put a newer version into what we've currently got. Yeah, there was a problem that the newer version of one of the dependencies that you actually used to build it, was broken. So I didn't update, and I put that into a PPA, which is a personal package archive. Yeah, and so I solved this problem, and I'm then trying to solve more problems, and then the other one came back.
What was it you were trying to fix really needed all this effort?
You lost me after hello.
No, I mean, okay, I'll probably go into it another time. But yeah, I've been doing some patching, and I've really been getting comfy with our patching mechanisms as well. So
our what as in Ubuntu's patching mechanisms?
For packages and stuff.
So. Okay, cool.
Well, cool. I'm glad you started with Dave, Simon.
Yeah, you can only get better. What have you been up to, Tony?
I had a nice week off, which was very nice, in the sun, sitting around doing not much. And I did listen to your Mile With Me, episode 29, which was great, and sort of listening, hearing you running along, and then halfway through the episode, you just disappeared.
Yeah, I got a sad on.
He couldn't keep up.
He left behind.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
Today, I've just got back from the UN-conference, the Open Source Schools UN-conference in Nottingham. So I left up at 5 o'clock this morning.
You gave a talk, didn't you?
I did give a talk, yeah. I had to drive 3 hours there and 3 hours back first. It was a very good conference. Lots of people were there, and I gave the talk, and people turned up to it, and we had lots of questions. So that was a win, and I got a cheeky plug-in for the podcast as well.
Excellent. Cheeky.
So hello to all those listeners who we picked up at Open Source Schools.
The dozens of them, I'm sure. And
Keep listening. It does get better.
But there were Ubuntu CDs on the information desks and stuff being given out.
Cool.
So it was there was an Ubuntu presence there.
Nice.
Wow.
Popey, what have you up to, mate?
Well, one thing, I went into my local co-op shop, and I had this T-shirt on, which is black, and it's got a little Ubuntu logo in the corner. And the bloke behind the counter said, "Nice Ubuntu T-shirt." And I said, "Oh, you've heard of it then?" And he said, "Yeah, I run it on my machine at home." I was like, "Yeah, brilliant. Good, random strangers knowing what Ubuntu is. That's fantastic."
Didn't we have that in London at the Expo?
Oh, it was a taxi driver.
And a barman.
Really?
A barman at the pub right opposite Olympia. So I think he was South African, but he sort of said, Ubuntu, I use that on my desktop. Ubuntu, I think.
His name was Mark, wasn't it?
No, Mark.
He had a
not
South African accent. I went around a friend's house because my wife had a party with loads of women around and I was kicked out. So I went around a friend's house to have a bit of a chaps, like geek out. So we got some pizza, played PlayStation 3, and he got his laptop out that he had Ubuntu on, and he'd installed it himself and it was all working fine. But it ran out of disk space, and he said, he had Windows on it, and he wanted to get rid of Windows to let Ubuntu take all the space. And when I looked at it, I didn't realise he'd done a Wubi install.
Ooh,
you know, where it puts Ubuntu inside. Yeah.
Did you delete the partition by any chance?
No, because how did I figure out that it was? Oh, that was it. We went to put the CD in because he was happy to wipe the whole thing. And I put the CD into boot off it. And then when we looked at the partitions, I was like, hang on a minute, where's the Ubuntu partition? And then looking a bit closer, we saw it was Wubi. So actually backed everything up onto a USB hard drive and did the old, you know, the depackage get selection thing where it backs up the list of all the things you've got. We did that and it all worked perfectly.
Oh, really?
Right. So in the space of 2 hours, we went from a Wubi install, backed everything up to a USB disk, wiped it, reinstalled Ubuntu, and put all the software back on and all his data back on, and he was back up and running.
Didn't you blog about this? Because I didn't know about the depackage thing, which is really quite useful. So it remembers, or you can list everything you've got installed.
It writes it out. You run a command that writes out a list of everything, all the packages you've got installed.
Yeah,
and you back that up, and I put it onto the USB drive. And then when you've done the reinstall, you've basically got a clean install,
yep,
and you put back your sources, your apt sources list,
yep,
and then you feed this list in, and then you run a couple of commands, and that's it. Cool.
That's now, on your blog, yeah.
But the thing, yeah, is, cool, that way of doing it, I actually read someone complaining about it, saying it wasn't recommended recently. I was just saying recently, it's probably a few months ago, and a better, I'm not sure exact reasons behind it, but the better one was actually one you just can't remember. The beauty of doing it that way is you really can easily remember, yeah, it. It's like dpackage space get selections,
yeah,
and then you just put them to text file.
I put the details in my blog, so if anyone wants,
yeah, to, yeah, but if anyone out there knows why that method's bad, I'd really like to hear,
yeah,
why.
Yeah.
I know something else you did.
What?
You have been patching Podcoder.
Oh, yeah, I did. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
What did I patch it for?
To do...
Oh, because, yeah, I wanted to change it so it didn't have season X, episode Y.
Yeah, yeah, change the naming conventions.
And then you changed all my patch.
I fixed it, your patch, I think is the term you're looking for.
Right.
So what I'm going to
do... So hang on, did you patch his patch?
I did, yeah. Podcoder is the script that we use to encode our episodes, and at least one other podcast uses it as well. To
really?
Yep, to use all the naming conventions, the metadata and stuff like that, and we've been trying to patch it a bit. And I'm going to put a blog post by the time this episode comes out on tonywhitmore.co.uk. I've already written it, so it should be fine. Just sort of asking for a bit of help, really, if you want to get involved. It's only a bash script, but it's quite a good project to go
hack
around.
It's quite easy to read. I mean, I picked it up, and I'm clueless. So,
well,
yeah.
I didn't want to say that.
Yeah.
Simon, what about you, mate?
Not a lot, really.
More running?
Actually, yeah, Stack's running. I think I ran almost 40 miles in the last 7 days.
Crikey!
Yeah, I'm a bit tired.
I drove 350, so
yeah,
you know,
I drive more. Yeah. Crunch Bang's anything I've been doing. Crunch Bang's out, 904, they've released that. And actually, we had some fun and games on the night of the release, didn't we? Because it was really difficult to get hold of.
Oh, he was a bit short of mirrors, I think.
Yeah, I think he basically overloaded his server. So we, Davey's got this fantastic mirror system.
Yeah, that we use for the podcast.
You should let us have that. Oh, I see. Right.
Oh, yes. Is that proprietary?
No. But
where can I get the code then?
Where can we get the code?
Show me the code.
Is it on your PPA?
No, it's not actually as a package.
Don't get him started on packaging again.
Yeah, yeah. But I am looking to actually rewrite the thing, to be honest. But actually, we should
but
talk.
It works. Come
yeah.
on.
Oh, yeah, but we should talk about that actually, because he needed more mirrors and he didn't know a lot of people would bandwidth, and he. And he actually did a blog post, and he included that on the Ubuntu UK Planet,
yep,
saying, you know, actually, I need more mirrors. I mean, I'm not sure how comfortable I feel about this. So perhaps we should actually talk about whether we should actually help promote projects, which are sort of, I mean, they are like almost a competition to Ubuntu. So perhaps, you know, we should actually think about, do we actually encourage diversity or not?
I think it's good to see the community rally around and help out a project. I mean, it's... derivative of Ubuntu, but you know, it's all one big happy family, isn't it?
It has to be. Otherwise, you know, where do we go? We just roll back to, well, we can't support Ubuntu because it's a Debian derivative.
Yeah. So, incidentally, I've never actually tried Crunchwrap.
You really should.
You just mirror it.
Well, I've pushed about like nearly 2 terabytes of it so far.
Good man.
So,
congratulations to them on their release, anyway.
Yeah,
it's good. It's very good. They've made a few changes. It's interesting to see Ubuntu is normally quite stable, and changes take a long time, it would appear, to come through. Take changing the music player, for example, has been going on, or potentially it's been going on for quite some time. Whereas I noticed on Crunch Bang, there's a couple of packages that have changed, like not the window manager.
Please tell me he's not using VLC.
I guess the fact that it's his own project. He can make those kind of decisions. He has less dependence, you know. Whereas Ubuntu is quite a big project, and to make those kind of decisions,
there's more process, isn't there?
Yeah.
I don't know if he's done it without process, because I'm not a great user of the forums. But there are changes there, and it's great, and it's slick, and it's fast, and I use it. I use Ubuntu too. It's nice. Have a look.
Oh well, let's get on with the show.
Sounds like a fun packed show. Now, of course, in the last episode, we discussed laptop security and about people recovering their laptops, what you do and things like that. I understand you've got a bit of a follow-up.
Yes. Well, there's one bit of news, which is the guy who had the Mac laptop that we talked about, who identified it online with some software that he already had that was backing up. Do you remember that one?
Yeah, it was inadvertently keeping a log, wasn't it?
Well, the police got a warrant, and they went to get it off of the woman.
Oh, yeah.
And the woman said... that it was given to her as a present back in January. by a friend of hers who bought it off of an online online website, Gumtree. The guy went to the police station to go and pick up his laptop once it had been recovered, and they said they felt quite sorry for her. Would he mind burning all her photos onto a CD for her? Which he did.
All thanks to Ubuntu. We got that back.
No, that was the Mac.
That was Mac.
Okay. All thanks to Ubuntu. All thanks to our podcast for announcing it over the internet.
What difference did our podcast
not
make?
Even remotely,
like, come on, no. Come on. We've got to try and take some credit for this.
No. Okay. However, there is one positive other story, and that is this morning I was sat on a train and someone left a laptop on the train.
And you bagged it?
And I put it on Gumtree.
No, I picked it up and I didn't trust anyone else to look after it. So I took it with me to work and I went through the bag and found a couple of business cards and got the phone numbers off the business cards. And I phoned the business cards, but I didn't know whether it was
their business cards,
their business
or something
else. Exactly, something they've been given. So I thought, I know, I'll spark the PC up and see what the logon name is. And then from that, you know,
and then have a few goes at the password as well.
Well, I didn't need to because it booted straight into the desktop.
Oh, there you go.
Windows XP.
Excellent.
And I just thought, oh, God, and shut it back down again. But the name, I looked in Task Manager because obviously there was no logon prompt. So yeah. I did Control-Alt-Delete and got the Task Manager thing up and saw the name and it was nothing like either of the names. So I thought, oh, well, this is lost hope. So I just shut it back down again, phoned up, and it turned out to be the bloke who was sat next to me who I was chatting about trains with about 10 minutes before he got off. So it's arguable that I probably distracted him from his laptop and it's my fault he left it there.
You're like one man crime spree, aren't you?
So have you spoken to him?
Yes, he came and picked it up. He came all the way to where I work.
Oh, nice one.
And I handed it over. And so he didn't have an encrypted laptop and he had it logged straight into Windows. So what we were talking about last week about data loss, you know, I could have taken all his company stuff off there and, you know.
Yeah, this is how all these big disasters about leaking personal information happen. 9 times out of 10, it's somebody leaving a laptop like that on a train.
So that was a company laptop or his own personal laptop?
Well, I don't know. It had company data on it. You could see from the icons on the desktop were, you know, important. I didn't open anything. There is the possibility that I'm breaking the law by turning it on because, you know, it's Computer Misuse Act. I'm not allowed to open that laptop up. But I figured the guy would want it back. So I thought that was acceptable.
So maybe we should think about marking outside. I mean, my USB sticks, you've seen me this. I name my USB sticks with my mobile phone number.
Oh,
so
yeah,
if somebody
yeah.
plugs it in, my mobile phone number's on there. So if I leave it somewhere, they can plug it in and go, oh, look.
And very quickly,
do you also put your PIN number in there for your cash card?
Yeah, no, that's in an encrypted section I do. So you should, David, maybe you should put your name and address on your laptops and phones and things when you leave them on trains.
You might get one back in the post every so often. You never know.
I also installed that software that Dave mentioned last week.
Did you?
Yes, I've installed it on the Mac.
Which software is that?
It's called Prey. And it's available for Windows, Mac, and Linux. And it's very simple. And it just does... We talked about it last time. It goes off
it
to a website.
It checks for a server, doesn't it?
Yeah.
A file on the server.
I thought about this, and the problem is that my laptop, if someone took it... You know, we talked about not being able to get online. And if it can't get online, it can't, you know, get to let me know that it's been stolen. So what I thought I'd do is create a guest account that auto-logs on.
Oh.
So if someone stole it and they turned it on, they'd get 30 seconds and it would just log on as a guest account.
Now, also following that, and how we sort of summed up that, in the last episode, we said, you know, more laptops are going to have things like that enabled. And we were actually talking to Chris Jones, weren't we?
Yes.
And
he's got a new laptop, hasn't he?
But the thing I was actually going to talk about is the actual chip that's inside it. Now, the next model up from his is actually even cooler because you can actually do a wake on LAN, you know, over cellular network.
So if his machine is stolen,
he can turn it on.
Send a text message, especially crafted text message to his laptop to wake up.
How awesome is that?
Hmm.
Yeah, I mean...
So the person who's got it, it suddenly turns on.
Yeah, but then it could turn on and then...
Had built-in GPS as well, I think.
Have a script that automatically deletes everything or something, you know.
Yeah. To me, I find that really quite cool.
It is quite cool. I can, if it all worked, it would be great, yeah.
Until someone does a wrong number or something.
Yeah.
But it seems to be something Intel seem to be throwing a lot of effort into at the moment, but I was quite impressed with that.
Hmm. So the other thing I created, the guest account and my account I encrypted, and I used a guide that's on Dustin Kirkland's website.
Ah, okay.
On his blog.
Well, that's really really useful, because we had quite a lot of feedback on the laptop security segment last time, and one of the emails we had was from Richard Marsh, who his nickname is Zabada.
Oh, yes. He sits on our IRC channel. Yes.
Excellent. I'm in there all the time. And he says, in the last podcast, you said you can't encrypt if you install using the live CD. So two questions. One, why not? And two, how is the best way to encrypt your home directory?
Yeah, it's not. I think I spoke to Colin Watson about this at the last release party and said, are you ever going to put stuff like RAID, LVM and encryption in the live CD? And he kind of, you know, said maybe. So I think it's just that it hasn't been written. And because there's been other important things to do with the installer that they haven't got to the encryption, LVM and RAID.
Yeah, if you use the live CD, at the moment there's not really a point and click way. There is the private directory, which we can talk to Dustin about later in the show.
There's no easy way to do it. You can do it with the alternate CD. It's fairly easy with the alternate CD.
Yeah, that's where you encrypt the whole partition, isn't it? Anyway, yeah. I mean, we'll talk to Dustin about this cool stuff.
I had a question. Does anybody know what encryption algorithm is used?
Isn't it AES?
I have no idea.
Okay. It could be like ROT13 for all you know.
Oh, and also, carry on.
I was just going to say, I mean, how did you... Did you encrypt your home directory? You did a reinstallation to encrypt
your... No, okay. I didn't have to. The guide that's on Dustin's blog, you don't have to reinstall. You have to do a bit of shenanigans. It's a load of command line stuff.
Oh, I can cope with that.
But it's not too painful, but it does result in just your home directory being encrypted. So it's not...
For a specific user.
Yes, so it's not the whole partition, because I don't have a separate home partition.
Do you need to be root to do that?
You use sudo a lot.
Okay. I was just curious, because sysadmining at home with the kids and things, I'm administrator on all of the laptops so that I can, you know, just check that nothing untoward's going on. But what I don't want them to do is for users to be able to encrypt their own home.
Well, you can easily do that. I mean, think about it. I mean, at the simplest level, you just need to create a tarball which is encrypted by PGP or something. Yeah. You won't be able to get into that.
Yeah, so I suppose there's... If they've got stuff to hide from dad, they're going to find a way to do it.
It's funny you should say that, because the other day, Sophie, who is my 5-year-old daughter, said to me, Daddy, why is it that you know my password, but I'm not allowed to know yours? And I had to think very fast on my feet. And I said, well, because I have to look after the computers, and sometimes when you break them, I have to fix them. So I need to know your password to fix it. But you don't ever fix the computer for me, do you? And she kind of went...
Daddy's got roots. There it is.
That will hold her for 6 months, maybe. Yeah,
I've got to think of something else quick.
Daddy, I think I can look after my own computer now.
You'll only do it once.
Well, it is a Mac.
Oh well. We had some more feedback. Dan Fish, great name, has sent us a link to a how-to for disk encryption that he found, which is based on Linux Mint, so it probably works on Ubuntu as well. And that's... on the Linux Mint forums, he says that even with his own dreadful grasp of encryption, he was able to get it up and running. So that's pretty good.
Yeah, it doesn't seem too bad. I mean, if you follow the command, the only problem I think you can get into this is if you do things like lose the key.
That's what I was going to say. You lose your passphrase and you're in for luck there.
Deep doo-doo.
And somebody called Tony Arnold, a fantastic first name, again, where they're all writing in. To talk about the laptop security thing again, saying encryption is the key, no pun intended. His laptop has two partitions, a small boot partition and one large encrypted partition with everything else in it. And that includes root directories, home directory and swap, and everything is in there. So he's pretty much got everything covered, really, apart from the bootloader, which is not secure. He also synchronizes his home directory to his desktop at work, and the one at home as well, using Unison, so like a three-way sync between his laptop, his home desktop, and his work desktop. Which is a great sync tool. So everything's backed up in two or three different locations.
Are they encrypted as well?
I was going to say.
Well, yeah. He doesn't say. But, I mean, that was something that I was thinking about. I was obviously thinking about encrypting my laptop or my Acer Aspire 1 home directory because that's what I take out and about with me and is more likely, perhaps, to get left on a train or nicked. If somebody sort of was to break into the house and steal my computers, I don't encrypt that at the moment. Maybe I should think about it, but... it's less likely, realistically, isn't it?
Well, I don't know. I mean, ever since we did the last show, I've been looking around the house and thinking, oh, look, there's a laptop sat there in in full view from the kitchen window. And there's one over there in full view from the front room. And really, maybe I shouldn't be doing that anymore.
But it's not like the guy on the train. It's not just people stealing them. It's you leaving them somewhere.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? Actually, I would imagine the majority of laptop thefts are actually people leaving them laying around.
I don't know. I have no stats to...
Can you get a human?
Yeah, but, I mean, this is my style. I throw some FUD up there and see if it sticks.
Wow, I didn't know you had a style, Dave. So Tony was finished writing that... I love you. Tony was finishing saying that in some circumstances, KCryptD, which he thinks is the daemon that's responsible for encrypting and decrypting the disk, can take over 20% of the CPU.
Crikey.
Yeah, because we were talking last week about and speculating on how much it eats. And actually on my machine, when I was copying photos... off of one machine onto my laptop that's now encrypted, it was so painful. But then reading the data off is fine.
Yeah, but also the other thing you need to look at is how often are you doing that intensive disk IO operations? You know, it's quite rare.
It's not just, I copy photos off my camera quite a lot.
And if you're doing a three-way sync using Unison, you're going to be doing it quite regularly because that's quite IO intensive. CPU intensive as well because it's doing it to compare. So it's going to put quite a bottleneck on it.
And if you've got any virtual machines and the VM sits, the disk image sits inside your encryption, that's going to hurt.
Yeah. But he says he's sufficiently confident in the encryption that he wouldn't worry too much if his laptop got stolen or lost. Mind you, my boss might give me grief when I ask for a new one, he says, which is good. And Mish, I don't know Mish's real name. Maybe you know? Okay. But he's sent us a couple of links on Phoronix about the performance.
Oh, yes, I did read that, yes.
Yeah, they're very sort of detailed performance analysis, which we won't bother to try and summarise here, except he says that it does create a bit of a performance hit. That's nice.
That's good enough.
That's good enough,
a bit.
Outside of very disk-intensive use cases, it's not significant. With full disk encryption, it seems to have a 5 to 10% hit on a real-world test.
Yeah, I don't notice it on my laptop when I'm booting up and stuff. Didn't really...
I'm wondering whether it would make my little netbook even slower than it is.
Yep.
Voice of experience.
Simon has spoken. Does that wrap up all the feedback from the laptop?
That does wrap up all the feedback.
And here's the news. In a further twist to the mono debate, Microsoft are releasing two specifications related to C# under their community promise, which allows anybody to use the specifications as a basis for their code under any license and without informing Microsoft.
Interesting.
Mm. Although the FSF have poo-pooed it and said it's not good enough.
Show of hands, who cares?
Those hands go up.
Who'd have thought, eh?
No hands.
More stuff to go into the mono debate,
yeah.
Which, by the way, we are just reporting.
I don't think we've actually expressed an opinion either way.
No, we've got a couple of emails, rants really, sort of telling us that we're either mono fanboys or mono haters. Mm-hmm. I can't remember which way around it was, but we're not. There's a lot of debate going on about mono at the moment,
and we're just reporting it.
Yeah.
In fact, some would say too much debate about mono at the moment.
I don't know. Debate's good.
That's controversial.
Yeah, you must be a hater.
I'm a freedom hater.
The BBC have released an open-source JavaScript library with multi-browser support designed to minimise the screaming and sobbing from web developers. They've also released a technology demonstration in the form of a falling letters typing game.
It's called Glow, isn't it?
It is called Glow, yes.
Has anyone tried it?
Well, no, I'm not a web developer.
No, me neither.
To be honest, it just looked
interesting.
I like the idea of web developers screaming and sobbing.
Yes.
It makes them feel like they're earning their money.
Inversely, they say that about sysadmins.
And they love mono as well.
Updates. Disk images of Ubuntu Hardy, the long-term support edition, has been made, including all the bug fixes and security updates since the last one.
Mm.
So that's 804.3?
Yes.
Yes.
Cool.
Nice one, number fans.
And yet, we still haven't had a Dapper one for quite a while.
Dapper's.
But yes.
End of, isn't it?
Not on only for the desktop.
No, that's true.
Mark Shuttleworth has discussed whether the next LTS release of Ubuntu will include GNOME 3, due for release at the same time. In an interview with Der Standard, he also talks about the problems with X.org and Jaunty and the ever-present question of Ubuntu themes.
Seriously, yeah. How can we not go for 3, considering it's an LTS? Because we're going to be supporting really old software by the time LTS comes.
The flip side is that it's really new software that might not work very well.
But it'll get stable.
Yeah, that's what
but it's LTS.
You want stable from the start in LTS absolutely. Release, don't you?
Yeah.
And a new theme is promised for the next LTS release as well.
Ooh.
Will it be brown?
Yep.
No.
It's pink.
This is a second Microsoft.
I say you're doing all the Microsoft news.
What,
today.
What is it? Yeah, I'm clearly a mono hater.
And now for the Microsoft
one. Which
lover.
One is it? Which one am I again? Microsoft have announced that a technology preview of Office 2010 has been released. This is presumably of interest to Linux geeks because of the greater ODF support included.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And it's got webby stuff in it and, you know, to compete with Google Docs and all that kind of malarkey.
Ooh. Okay then, Mr. Microsoft, take it easy. Round 3 of the 100 paper cut scheme has been announced, with 10 more niggles getting attention. This time around, they include the overusage of the system beep and having file icons dim when cutting and pasting them in the File Explorer. David Siegel also blogged on the progress of the Round 2 paper cuts. 5 paper cuts have been healed, 3 are in the works, and 4 need more developer help to resolve.
And they're plastering it all over the internet. The real-time historical strategy game, Zero AD, has announced that they are releasing their code under the GPL, with the artwork being released under a Creative Commons license. Would-be contributors can now access their subversion and track servers, although there is still a question mark over the licensing of the contributed code.
It looks quite cute, actually. Well, cute as in a game can look.
Yeah, it does look. It's very polished, and I'm not a gamer, but to my eyes it looks like a good game.
Yeah,
and
I guess
great
it's not something that you can just dive straight in and start hacking away on the code. I guess there's going to be some learning, because they've been going for how long? 10 years or something?
It's interesting that I'd never heard of this game, but the fact they're releasing it under the GPL, I've now heard of it and I'm going to look at it.
Mm.
But it's also the artwork as well, so you can have graphic designers making better men or women fight or die or whatever they do.
You're really not a gamer, are you, Tony?
No.
After years of speculation, Google have finally announced their new operating system, Chrome OS. Unsurprisingly, the OS will focus on web applications and the code will be open source later this year. The first release will be available on netbooks in about 6 months.
8 months, I reckon.
Maybe not in the UK, straight away.
Mm. What do we think? Is this good or bad for Linux?
It's open source, so it's going to be good.
Yeah, but the other side is I'm imagining it's not going to have too much impact on the Windows stuff. So is it going to further dilute the Mac and Linux desktop?
Well, in the same way that Chrome has completely dented Firefox.
I think it will, you know. Mm. I really do.
And finally, in a spectacular display of blowing one's own trumpet, this very podcast you're listening to, yes, you listener, has clocked up an amazing 500,000 downloads since we started back in March 2008. Thank you very much for listening, and please keep doing so.
Yes, thank you very much indeed.
Although we are relying on Dave Scripps to tell us that it's 500,000. So.
Well, okay, and the web server logs, if you really wanted to grep them.
This is
but
true.
Actually, if we, hang on, listener, you are download episode 500,134.
Are you going to record all the numbers that we'll plug them in and host all the 500,000?
He's got plenty of time. Now he hasn't got to sit there and click download 500,000 times as well.
No, I wrote a script to do it. It's a simple bash script.
We've got some events coming up. Software Freedom Day this year is a couple of months away, in Saturday the 19th of September 2009.
Mm. We've been invited over to Dublin.
Have we?
Yes.
Have we?
Oh, wait. Are they paying?
No. No. But it's quite cheap to get to Dublin. If you go on a evil,
do you need
airplane.
Injections?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Do you need a passport?
Probably.
Atlanta Linux Fest, also the 19th of September 2009 at the IBM facility on Northside Parkway.
Have we been invited to that as well?
Well, I think there's a global invite to that. Really.
Okay.
Should we just turn up and just see if we feel comfortable or not?
See you there, mate. Don't forget the Ubuntu Global Jam is on the 2nd to the 4th of October 2009.
Yeah, there's some meetings online. Jono's organising some, I think, on IRC. You attended one the other day, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
Where it was discussed what was going to happen at the Global Jam and what kind of things happen.
And who's going to bring the saucepan?
I can bring the fruit.
I'll bring the sugar.
Nice. Jammy.
Look Radio Live 2009 is on the 24th of October at Newham Arts Centre, Wolverhampton.
And for Fosdem, a new event coming into our schedule.
Did you have to
here.
Do that?
I didn't have to. I just felt exuberant.
Okay.
6th and 7th of February, so slightly earlier than normal.
But also, surprisingly, they've actually announced the dates much earlier than they have previously.
They're anticipating big crowds.
Yep, and at the same venue, which I'm not going to try and say, but it's the University in Brussels.
Right, this week's Command Line Love. Just trying to...
We're changing the name of this.
Command Line Love.
Command Line Phyllis.
Cooler one.
This is quite a useful one. I obviously use Crunchbang, and you have the ability to put a clock basically anywhere on your desktop. It uses three different commands. It uses watch, date, and figlet to give you a clock on the desktop, and you can move it around, and you can change the font and all sorts of good stuff.
What's figlet?
Frank, Ian and Glenn's letters.
Nice one. Ooh. I learned that today, actually. The great thing about these three commands is they're really quite small. They're not massive. And you need to get into the manual. So, for example, you go man watch to look at the switches within watch to see what you can and can't do with these three different commands.
We've mentioned watch before, actually, when we talked about obsessively watching things like RAID arrays rebuilding.
Oh, yeah.
It just keeps stuff on the screen and dynamically updates.
It shows you the differences, doesn't it, between...
And so, yeah, I can do deltas, yeah.
So what we're actually using this for is to actually to basically rerun the command every second. Is that what you're saying?
That's right, yeah. So you run the command, date command, every second, and pipe the output from date to figlet, which gives you a big font.
Like ASCII text.
Yeah.
ASCII.
Now, I've heard rumours that figlet is evil proprietary software.
Well, yeah. Well,
it's in multiverse.
If you install VRMS, VRMS says it's nasty evil software. And I happened to mention on a mailing list that I thought VRMS said it was evil software. And I got an email from one of, I can't remember which one it was, Frank, Ian or Glenn, out of Frank, Ian and Glenn's letters, Figlet. I got an email from one of them saying, what can they do to make it free? I can't remember what we decided in the end, but
But also, since the last couple releases, if you actually try and install Figlet, you actually get prompted. You can, you know, with the command not found, you can either install Figlet or Toilet, can't you?
I didn't know that.
So actually, Toilet provides a compatible binary for Figlet, but although it doesn't actually produce the same output.
Chat. Bizarre. Dave started talking about toilets again, two episodes in a row.
And then if you put that into your IT.
I've just tried running the command here, and it's great. I've got a little terminal with a big time
clock
on it.
Yeah, it's good, isn't it?
We could use that and maybe finish the episode on time.
Yeah, well, the great thing is you can cut the border off, float it above, and it's always there.
I'm not sure the Viglin's up to the task of refreshing the screen once every second.
True.
Okay, so we've got Dustin Kirkland on the line now. Now, Dustin's actually one of the heroes from the Ubuntu server team. If there's cool stuff coming along, Dustin's probably related to it. So Dustin, tell us a bit about yourself. What do you do?
Hey, Dave. So a developer on the server team, quite a cool job, engineer, working full-time on Ubuntu. It's a dream come true from one perspective.
Okay, and what are the sort of things that you work at on the server team?
Right, so most of my time I spend on the virtualization stack, the Linux virtualization stack. So for Ubuntu, that means KVM plus libvirt, and then a kind of a stack of utilities that use libvirt and KVM under the covers.
So KVM, the kind of it's kind of fairly relatively new compared to some of the other virtualization stuff, like such as Xen. And I know some people will have used Xen or will be aware of Xen, the history of it. Do you know why we use or why we promote or what? Why in Ubuntu KVM seems to be the favorite over Xen?
Right, it's mostly an implementation difference. With Xen, the hypervisor, the machine that's running other virtual machines, requires a heavily patched Linux kernel. KVM itself is a hypervisor within the Linux kernel itself, And it really doesn't require any out-of-band patches. From a maintenance perspective on the Ubuntu side, it means that we've got a far smaller diff from the mainline Linux kernel as opposed to other distributions that tend to use Xen. That being said, we do have Linux Xen kernels available in the Universe repository. It's just not something that Canonical is officially supporting.
Okay, so it's mainly because it's in the kernel already, and it's more easy to support from a Canonical's point of view, would you say?
Absolutely, yeah. One of the key differences is that KVM requires hardware enablement in the hardware. You need something called virtualization technology in the CPU. Now, any modern Intel or AMD CPU, particularly on a server, but in fact on most desktops and laptops, have virtualization technology built in. And so trying to support a technology which every day is sort of eking itself out of existence is just a choice that we decided against.
Right. And you mentioned, so KVM is the hypervisor and the virtualization kind of part of it. What's libvirt? What does that do for me?
Right, so there's a couple of other pieces. KVM, I'll just define kernel virtual machine. Like you said, that's the hypervisor itself. There's another very important piece called QEMU, which stands for Quick Emulation. QEMU is actually the sort of user space utility that provides emulation of all the drivers and the other bits of the physical machine that
such as like virtual hard disks and things like that.
Yeah, virtual hard disks, virtual network, virtual video adapter, and so forth. QEMU does sort of the hard work for the bits that is not in the kernel itself. That said, libvirt is sort of an abstraction layer. It's a library layer that lots of other user space utilities can call into and have these requests sort of abstracted away and executed on whatever virtualization technology you decide to have under the covers, be that Xen or KVM, and in some cases support for things like VMware is coming along.
So I could have a graphical front end, say for example on my management console or my desktop, and press buttons in the GUI, and abstracted through libvirt at the back end, there could be Xen machines, KVM, QEMU, or whatever that I'm managing and controlling with that.
Yeah, that's exactly the idea. Virt Manager is one of the more well-known sort of graphical front ends. Create me a virtual machine. Virt Manager talks through libvirt, which means that libvirt then handles deploying that on Xen or KVM or whichever virtualization technology you've configured.
And how mature would you say the graphical user interface is, I mean, compared with something like VMware's ESX, say?
Virt Manager specifically?
Yeah, well, the solutions that we have on Linux, the free software solutions.
You know, I don't think most people would deny that the graphical interfaces are not on par with something like ESX. That said, the underlying technology, I think, is absolutely on par with VMware. I think KVM is as good of a hypervisor and technical implementation of a virtual machine as say, VMware is. The tooling on top still has a little ways to go, but that's really not something that people have invested heavily upon, mainly because I think people tend to use much lower level interfaces. I guess the more advanced users of virtualization are using something like Virsh, the virtual shell, which provides a really cool scriptable command line interface to managing virtual machines. And also looking a bit higher up in the stack, we're working quite closely with the Eucalyptus community and the Eucalyptus team and project. We've partnered with that company to deliver a cloud solution on top of Ubuntu.
So a quick question then. If I've got a lot of virtual machines based on Xen, should I be looking to migrate to KVM?
Potentially. It really depends on what your goal is. Xen continues to fill a gap, a very important gap, which is virtualization on older hardware. You know, let's say that you've got some 5 or 6 year old servers that are still doing good things for you. They're still operational. It's just that they don't have the virtualization technology on the chip. I think I would certainly look at any new hardware you're acquiring into your lab, ensure that it has VT on board, and start looking at Zen as your KVM as your hypervisor. In terms of migrating, it's pretty easy actually to migrate these virtual machine images from hypervisor to hypervisor.
Is the hardware, the virtualized hardware inside a Zen machine, similar to the virtualized hardware inside a KVM or QEMU machine?
Yeah, well, actually, all of them, Zen, KVM, and QEMU, all ultimately use QEMU as the hardware driver model. At that level, they're all basically using the same thing. It's all QEMU.
Okay.
Also, at the libvirt level, libvirt is abstracting away some of the differences between the two.
So if you boot up a machine that used to be a Zen VM inside KVM or QEMU, it's not going to be surprised at the all the new hardware around virtualized.
No, it shouldn't. And particularly, I guess I can't really speak for, say, Windows or even other Linux distributions, but from an Ubuntu perspective, they should be really, really similar, in fact, and it may well just work, albeit that's not something that I've tried. I haven't run Zen in several years, actually.
Dustin, you mentioned just then about cloud computing and serving. One of the other things you've just released is PowerNap. Tell us about PowerNap.
Yeah, so PowerNap's actually kind of cool. This is part of, I guess, a small initiative within Canonical and then within Ubuntu to try and make the Ubuntu server sort of an energy-conscious distribution. I would like to think that we have the potential to become a sort of your top choice if you're looking for energy efficiency in your data center. I hope people start to associate that with the Ubuntu server. And we've done a few things in the last couple of releases to help that. And Jaunty in particular, we packaged a couple of new upstream projects. We also turned on CPU frequency scaling by default, which is, I think, a subtle but really important difference. Which means that Ubuntu servers, Jaunty and beyond, are running with the on-demand governor, such that if they're idle, the CPU spins itself down, if your CPU supports that, obviously. As your demand requires, the CPU frequency will scale up. The next step beyond that, I did some work in the Jaunty release cycle testing PM suspend and PM hibernate on servers. So what this meant was a couple of subtle changes to the packaging, but ensuring that the PM utils package could install on command line only interfaces, and if your BIOS actually tells the kernel that it supports the S3 and S4 sleep states, which are suspend to memory and suspend to disk, then you can call PM suspend and PM hibernate to power the system down or bring the system to a lower power state.
But of course, they may have a problem if it's a remote server. How do you wake it up?
How do you wake it up? Exactly. So there's a couple of different remote waking technologies. Probably the most ubiquitous is wake on LAN, which also requires support in the BIOS or actually on the Ethernet card. But most Ethernet cards created in the last 10 years or so support wake on LAN. Wake on LAN is a real primitive technology. A magic packet, so to speak, is transmitted, broadcast over the local network. The systems who have wake on LAN enabled are sort of watching, even while they're powered off, they're sort of watching for this magic packet to come across the wire. And when it does, it can talk through the ACPI interface and wake the system up.
See, I've always heard it being called magic cookie, and to me, that's a much more favorable term.
Magic cookie, yeah. That's not one that I've heard.
Dave has his own terms for everything. Don't worry about it, Dustin.
You get used to it.
Yeah, but wake on LAN is a pretty primitive technology. IPMI is certainly more prevalent in data centers. Wake on LAN's got some limitations. It only works on the local subnet. Obviously, you can't go broadcasting these packets over the internet, whereas IPMI provides a layer or a tunnel, so to speak, to get across subnets. So
the idea is you have lots of machines in your data center, and you can power down huge swathes of them when demand is low,
whatever your time zone, if you're a, you know, 9-to-5 business, you can power down large parts of your cloud, for example, and then wake them all up at the, you know, before your peak load and be ready for it. Is that the idea?
Yeah, that's the basic idea. So the implementation of PowerNap itself, it's basically like a screensaver for servers. So
you get pipes and flying toasters and things.
Right. So in your laptop or desktop case, your screensaver is monitoring activity on the keyboard and the mouse. And if neither of those happen for some period of time that you get to configure, boom, the machine the screensaver will kick in. And in some cases, if you've tweaked your GNOME Power Manager settings, you can have the system actually suspend or hibernate itself. Well, we've taken that same idea and applied it to servers, but in addition to watching the keyboard and the mouse, we're also watching the console and remote connections. So, you know, if you're on an SSH to the system, it will also sort of note that you've got activity in that given SSH session. But beyond that, you get to specify a list of processes. And these are the critical processes that you define to be, that need to be running for the system to be powered on. So if the system is a cloud machine then, and it's in the Ubuntu cloud where we use KVM, the key process is user bin KVM. If user bin KVM is in the process table, then we don't want the system to go to sleep. Sure. We don't want it to take a power nap. But as soon as that all KVM processes have dropped out of the process table, and some period of time has gone by, and there's no activity on the keyboard, there's no activity on the mouse, there's no activity in SSH, the system is deemed to be a candidate for power nap, and so we'll emit a message which says, if nothing happens in the next 60 seconds, this system is going to take a power nap. Where power nap can be an action that you define, such as, I don't know, sending yourself an email, or by default, it will try successively in order to try and suspend. If that doesn't work, to try and hibernate, and if that doesn't work, it'll actually power down.
Okay. Just out of interest, how do you actually send out this message saying, you know, I'm going to basically shut down or suspend in 60 seconds? What sort of networking? How do you actually do that?
Wall.
Ye olde technology.
Yeah, so that's pretty primitive. Actually, I've got a bug open in Launchpad to have wall support in Notify OSD because I'm doing quite a bit of testing here on my laptop, and if I'm not actually watching my terminal at that moment, I don't get the wall message. It'd be nice if I got.
Oh, you use wall. I see. Okay.
But the idea then is, I mean, most of these systems, if this is going to be used in a cloud scenario, they don't really have active users working on them, generally. They are Ubuntu servers without GNOME or any sort of graphical desktop, and they're mostly unattended. And so the idea is that they would go down when they're unused. The other piece of this is Power Wake. If you think of Power Wake as sort of a wake on LAN on steroids, but I guess it's sort of the way we talked about libvirt earlier. It's intended to abstract away your remote waking methodology. So right now it only supports wake on LAN, but I'm working on support for IPMI. So you would say power wake a given system, and then power wake's got some smarts in it that does ARP caching, so it'll cache the MAC addresses so that you don't have to remember the MAC address of every server in your lab. It'll associate those with IP addresses and host names so that you can use IP addresses or host names, and it'll do a best effort matching, but also it responds to static configuration as well.
Cool. That sounds really good. I'll look out for that in future releases.
Now, we had a competition in the last episode to give away an Arduino board, which was a Dura Milanovi 328 board, which is a new board. We talked about the hardware hacking platform that is Arduino, and a copy of the Getting Started with Arduino book from O'Reilly.
And this is provided by Tinker.it.
Yeah, sorry, the board is provided by Tinker.it, and the book is provided by O'Reilly.
Ah, okay.
And we had a question in order to be able to win the book and the board. And the question was, there are some Arduino tutorials on the Tinker IT website. How much does the equipment for the RFID tutorial cost? And the answers we had were...
£3.50, £35.49, £350, and Fred Perry in 1936.
Okay, and Simon, the right answer was...
£35.49p.
Okay, and we had apparently loads of entries. I don't know how many that is. That's loads.
More than one.
More than five. more than 10.
Laura's nodding quietly.
Is that a metric or imperial loads?
Okay, and we have a lucky winner, and the winner is Dave.
The winner is not Dave.
The winner is not Dave.
Yay! Oh.
The winner is Dave. Who's the winner?
The winner is Robert Meinek in California, US.
Wow. Ah, congratulations, Robert.
Glad we don't have to pay for the posting for that one.
Yeah, thank you to the Tinker IT people for donating the prize and offering to pay for the posting. Well, we've got to post the book, though.
And
yeah.
I've got the book.
Okay. Yay! Can't we just scan in and email a PDF? So
I don't think that counts.
The word copyright springs to mind.
Freedom Painter.
So what are we going to call it this week? We've had Gerald, well, Gerald something else.
I don't want to know about you having Phyllis. Gerald.
Harold was the middle
Harold,
one.
Gerald, Harold, Phyllis.
I think in a tribute to our guest, we should call it the Ubuntu Dust Affair or something.
Dust Affair. Okay, we'll go with Dust Affair. You try and explain that when it appears on Planet Ubuntu. Okay, there are some planned changes to the Code of Conduct, which is what a lot of Ubuntu users sign before they become Ubuntu members or before they can become Ubuntu members. They sign the Code of Conduct, which outlines some ways to behave within the Ubuntu community, and there's some changes. Mako has made some changes, and I'll post a link to his revisions. And it's been talked about by the community council, and it will be decided on soon whether those will be final or not.
And just to summarise, what are they?
It's changing some of the wording. It's not dramatically changed, but it's changing the wording a little bit.
Now, hang on. Do people automatically sign the new version?
It's good. I asked that question during the meeting, and they weren't sure whether it would be a case of Alan has signed version 1 of the Code of Conduct, and then there's version 2, and you can elect to sign that, or whether your signing becomes upgraded, or something a bit like, you know, the GPL version 2 or later, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Not sure how it's going to happen.
And there's going to be a discussion about adding new members to the community council, isn't there?
Yes.
There's a vote imminent, I understand.
There's 8 members of the CC,
right,
but it's only got 4 people on it at the moment. And so there's room for 4 more, because 4 people, I think some people have expired.
4 and 4
makes 8.
Okay, I'm with you, yeah.
Yeah.
And the technical board's got votes as well going on,
yes,
at the moment,
both
isn't
of
it?
Them. Yeah, because the thing is, loads of users have expired in Launchpad, and some people have stepped down.
Right.
So there's room for, you know, new people.
In this credit crunch time, all the boards are taking on more people. Crazy.
Yeah, they're not paid.
Oh, well, that's something to do with your spare time, I suppose.
Absolutely.
So are you on any of those?
I'm not on the CC or the technical board, no.
Maybe you should be.
I should, full disclosure, I think someone has put my name forward for one of them.
Was that person yourself?
No. Yeah, signed up with a new Gmail account. I think Alan should be on the CC. He's fantastic.
Vote down.
But all Ubuntu members get to vote on CC and technical board, I think. Maybe only the CC. I think the CC vote on the technical board.
Developers?
No. The technical one did say
developers.
Yeah, it did say all Ubuntu developers. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Now, I actually wondered quite how they actually clarify what a Ubuntu developer is.
It's a member of Ubuntu Motu, isn't it?
There's
a team on Launchpad, I think, that they use to determine.
Mm.
I love this Ubuntu administrivia. It's fascinating.
No, it's not.
Oh, okay.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
I wouldn't go as far as fascinating.
Okay. Somewhere between the two, maybe.
Yes.
Now we've got Felipe
Alfaro?
Yes.
Yeah, sounds about right.
He actually wrote a blog post about LVM snapshots and non-destructive Linux upgrades.
Yeah.
What's it all about, Dave?
I think what Dave wants to say is that it's about using LVM to enable you to do an upgrade of a system, and then in the event that it goes horribly wrong...
Or destructive... In the event that it is destructive.
Okay. Yeah, I think what Dave wants to say is that in the event that it goes wrong, you can roll it back.
So you can take a snapshot,
do an upgrade,
muck it all up, and recover it if it all goes wrong.
But the thing is, he's actually talking about using LVM, but mm-hmm. we've now actually got do release upgrade that can actually do it using an AuthFS overlay. Which
can
is
that already do that?
Well, there's a switch for it. I haven't tried it.
Oh, wow. I thought that was all experimental and a bit scary.
Well, there's a switch for it.
Right, okay. You try that and report back whether it worked.
Yes, sir.
Right, Tux Radar, those fine team, have benchmarked Ubuntu, Vista, and also Windows 7, apparently.
Mm. And they've used the same hardware for the tests. And it's quite good, actually. Lots of pretty graphs.
Yeah, and they've tested about 4 different versions of Ubuntu and 4 different versions of Windows. So Vista and Windows 7 on 64 and 32-bit platforms.
Oh, cool.
And it's Ubuntu 8.10 and 9.04 again on 64 and 32-bit.
Is there a conclusion?
The graphs are pretty.
Actually, generally, from my interpretation, Ubuntu did actually perform better. But there was one case, was it better? I can't remember what it was now, but Windows did actually perform better in one area, I seem to remember.
Yeah, I mean, there's some that are quite close.
Yeah.
And they're looking at some of them aren't very scientific benchmarks. They're things like how many mouse clicks does it take to install the operating system?
I saw that one, yeah.
And how long does it take to do it? And how long does it take to boot up and shut down? And obviously, in the more recent versions of Ubuntu, there's a lot of work gone into that, whereas perhaps there wasn't in Vista, in that it takes a year to boot.
Actually, I'm amazed how long it takes to shut down. But this isn't the Vista podcast, so we'll leave that.
Ken Weimer from the artwork team has been requesting backgrounds for Karmic. So these are photos and other nice artistry that can go as backdrop images. He wants to collect a whole load of really high-quality pictures to go on the background.
It's for a desktop extras package, I think, isn't it?
Oh, is so it? They're going to be packaged up?
So you can install it and get a load of new funky wallpapers.
Oh, cool.
Pretty wallpapers. There's a cautionary tale from Victor Churchill on the Hampshire Lug mailing list, who managed to fill his Gmail account. Yeah. Which is quite a good
fill it.
Yeah.
Yes. That was 7 gig, isn't it?
It's probably something like, yeah, 7
it's big, but
gig.
Whatever it is, he filled it.
Blimey.
Something to do with his her server sending out 3,450 emails in a few hours, totaling 4.2 gigabytes of email. Which I think all sorts of logs and things attached to these emails as part of an automatic kind of fault reporting system. Of course, then when the system filled up, when his Gmail account filled up, the emails got bounced back to the server.
which then tried
to forward them back on again. It all got a bit messy, I think.
We'll post a link. It's quite a cracking story, actually.
Crikey, that sounds fun.
So it is possible to fill up your Gmail, whatever they might tell
and
you.
And actually, on a similar note, something I've noticed in Karmic is actually, if you fill up your home partition, it comes up with a dialogue, say your disk is 99% full, do you want to inspect it?
It does the same for USB sticks as well. I plugged a full USB stick in and a box pops up, yeah.
And then you can have, because normally I would use the command line to do that. Yeah. Use like disk use and things
but
like
when,
that.
But when you press the analyze button, it opens up the disk usage analyzer
thing. Yeah, which is actually really good because you can go like dig into trees and see where all the space is going.
Yeah, nice graphical chart. It's really cool. I like that, yeah.
The outlook is hazy for Banshee and Karmic.
Yeah, some, what's his name?
What's his name? That's what I was trying to think of. Yes.
Joe Shields.
Yes. DirectX. Yes.
Yes. He's blogged about how it's possible Banshee won't make Karmic after all.
Now, Banshee is mono, isn't it? And
it uses mono.
Yes, yes.
That's not the reason why.
No, but that's what I'm saying. And that's coming from the guy that's really quite into mono, isn't it?
Well, he is a developer, and he is the developer of mono applications that are built on mono, yes.
But it's worth mentioning that the sticking points don't seem to be anything related to mono. They're to do with the release schedule, the fact that there's a new version in beta that won't be finalised by the time that Karmic's released, some documentation that needs writing and some accessibility work and things like that. Mm. So it's technical stuff, but not the fact that it's mono or whatever.
I wonder if we'll stick with Rhythmbox for this release.
I can't see us changing to something else. If Banshee's not going to be ready, what else would we change to? And why would we? What possible reason is there to change?
Apparently there's going to be a Kubuntu netbook edition for Karmic.
Ah, so like we've got an Ubuntu netbook remix, we'll have a Kubuntu netbook remix.
KDE on a netbook.
But surely the netbook remix uses that special customised interface anyway. Is there a KDE equivalent of the customised interface?
Yeah, but you don't get any KDE apps, do you? You get all GNOME apps. You get Pidgin.
Okay, so
you don't get the KDE.
Same interface, but with KDE apps?
I don't know.
Why not?
What, why not?
What, why don't you know?
I don't know.
Well, you come here and tell
me. Maybe if I was elected to something like the CC, yes, I would know these things.
Right, there we go.
Oh, God, that's got to be.
There's a platform on which to stand. And that's all in the Dustosphere. What was it, Dave? The Dustosphere.
Dustosphere.
Okay, we've had your feedback. We've had a lot of feedback since the last episode, which either means we're doing something right or something very wrong. Tony Purcell emailed in saying that last season he could start listening to our podcasts on his EPC, stop them and restart from where he left off. Now he finds that if he cannot listen to all the podcasts in one go, he has to start all over again from the beginning. Have we changed the way that we deliver the podcasts, or is he doing something wrong? He loves listening to the show, but the repetition is quite wearing after a while. I can't think there's a problem with that, having to listen to the thing over and over again.
Okay. Yeah, we do.
Yeah, this is true.
Okay. I think I can answer this, actually. If you revert Alan's patch to Podcoder, I reckon it resolves this.
Unfortunately, Tony doesn't mention what software he's using to play the podcast, so it's a little bit tricky to second guess that. Mm. But we've not really changed anything. Just Alan's patches haven't been used yet in a live environment. They're still going through QA.
And never will.
So no, I don't think there's anything we've changed. Perhaps there's been an upgrade to some of the software in the EPC that he's running.
Arand Nash emailed in saying, first of all, I really like your show. Yay!
Cool.
Secondly, my MP3 player doesn't. Oh. I'm having some problems with the media on my player. Cowan, iAudio U2. The OGG files, high and low, crashes the firmware. It makes the device reboot.
Nice.
And on the high-quality version of MP3, the time is all messed up, meaning it's wacko to fast-forward and rewind. The only thing that works is the low-quality MP3. All other OGGs I've played play on it just fine. I talked to Mr. Pope on the relays.
I think he means IRC there.
And said I should check... check out versions with no variable bitrate and or no graphic embed.
Yeah, we've had this came before. I think, I can't remember who it was, but somebody else with a Cowan audio player, and we sent a load of links to versions that didn't have the embedded album art and didn't have and had a constant bitrate rather than a variable bitrate, and then didn't hear anything back. So maybe the whole thing exploded in a big heap. But... yeah, there's something. We don't do anything really weird with our OGGs. We just produce them using OGG Inc, which is the standard tool for encoding to these things. But if somebody has actually wants to kind of test out these things, has got a device that's giving us problems, either send us one, that would be really good, or you know, give us sort of rapid feedback on the versions that we supply, which are these special constant bitrate ones and ones without the album art. That would be really, really good.
Simon Weirs has sent us a message. He downloads the podcast straight to his iPhone and has noticed that season 2, episodes 7 and 8 are tagged incorrectly, he believes. Actually, it's not. But anyway, it's being stored under a new artist. All previous episodes come under Ubuntu UK Podcast, but episode 7 and episode 8 come under Ubuntu Podcast from the UK Loco team. His thought is something that has been tagged incorrectly. You may want to have a look, or we may want to talk to Popey.
Yeah, Alan fiddled.
Yeah, that's my fault. There you go. I changed the name of the podcast from Ubuntu UK Podcast to Ubuntu Podcast from the UK Loco team so that it was consistent across a number of pages and also consistent with the thing and also meant we show up better in iTunes if you search for Ubuntu Podcasts.
It's all part of our big plan to conquer the world.
Good yes.
But the interesting thing is that we haven't changed anything in the files itself. So
iTunes must be reading.
It must be reading from the website and the XML feed.
Oh, crikey, biggest one to read so far. John Totes wrote, firstly, to say the whole show is really good and I'm trying to catch up through all the old episodes. Thank you very much.
Good
John.
Luck.
Very kind of you to say. He says, I know it's probably an old point, but I just listened to season 1, episode 5, 15, when you were discussing users not reporting bugs. I would say I'm an experienced computer user, but only moved to Ubuntu around a year ago and completely converted, apart from damn it iTunes. But I still haven't posted any bug reports. I don't want it to sound like an excuse, but I just wouldn't know what to put, and it's... especially wouldn't want to put the wrong thing and then waste developers' time. An example is I just moved to the 64-bit version and started playing around with compies, but the whole system feels really buggy compared to 32-bit. When watching a video and moving the box, I had a kernel panic.
Ooh.
Yeah. Tried checking the logs and couldn't find anything useful information. I didn't know if it was the video player or compies or some other process. Maybe in an episode you could describe how to go about filing a bug report in the most useful way, because I really do want to help the community.
That sounds like a really good idea. I think we could sort of talk. I find it confusing. I tried to file a bug the other week, and I got a nice response, but it sort of said this information is not the information we would want. And that was using the Ubuntu bug tool.
Yeah.
Bug tool. Goodness me. Where that came from.
But yeah, we'll probably cover that in a forthcoming episode.
After we talked about various media players, Aldo Nogueiro wrote that he uses Songbird as a podcast reader. It works well with BBC News Pod and the World Technology Podcast, but doesn't even download the list of episodes for the Ubuntu UK podcast. It does. He's tried the OGG version with the same results. He's using Ubuntu 9.04 behind a proxy with authorization, or presumably authentication. Does anybody know what he can do to make it work? Alan says it does work.
Well,
did actually, you try it behind a proxy with authorization?
No, I didn't. To be fair, I didn't. But actually, Songbird doesn't support podcasts. It doesn't have like a menu option for doing podcasts. But because it's based on Mozilla stuff, it actually has like a browser built in. And if you visit a URL, which is an RSS feed for a podcast, it brings up the web page in the top half of the screen. And then the bottom half, it turns into like a list of all the episodes with download buttons next to them.
That's neat.
Looks a bit like iTunes, the download thing you get in iTunes.
Right.
And so you can just go click, 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 download, and you get a little percentage bar and everything, and it works really nicely. So it doesn't actually support podcasts directly, but you can do it. But no, I didn't try behind a proxy authenticating or not.
Okay, well, Aldo says that the podcast is really interesting and funny, and it helps to make his accent a little more British.
That's rather good.
Hamish writes to tell us, you complained on the podcast that Firefox 3.5 was only available in a PPA.
Actually, however, it's Dave complained about that.
However, it's been in the Universe repository in Jaunty for a while now. And he gives us a link to packages.ubuntu.com. It's true that it could have been better publicised, but I think I saw a few references to the Planet Ubuntu along this way.
Yeah, I think we've had the beta in Jaunty for a while.
And it still is, isn't it?
No, it's the final release in Jaunty.
Oh.
But it's not called Firefox 3.5. In Jaunty, it's called the developer name Shiratoko.
Something like that.
Yeah, yes. Shiratoko. But the reason is so that you don't have two Firefoxes on your system with the same branding. So the Firefox that comes with Jaunty is Firefox 3.0. And that's got the Firefox branding. But if you install Firefox 3.5 from the repository, it's still called Shiratoko. So you don't confuse the two.
Albert Hickey wrote in and said that he heard on another Linux podcast that the Arduino price point was set by the price of a pizza in Italy. So the design students could either have a pizza or an Arduino.
What would you choose?
Pizza.
Right now,
I'd probably choose an Arduino, actually, yeah.
Yeah, well,
I would just have both. Can I have like half and half?
A margarita Arduino.
Yeah, to a duo for Margie and LED chips.
Thanks for listening, and thanks to everyone who took part via Twitter and Identica. If you'd like to get hold of us, you can email the show via podcast@ubuntu-uk.org or leave 30 seconds of voicemail on 0845 508 1986.
You can send us your comments on Identica via identi.ca/UUPC or Twitter, which is twitter.com/UUPC, as well as getting updates from recording sessions.
Alternatively, if you're into IRC, you can chat to us via the #Ubuntu-UK channel on the Freenode IRC network.
Join our Facebook fan page, search for Ubuntu UK podcast.
How many are we up to now?
I don't know.
It was 137 last week.
Okay.
Confident. Oh, we welcome suggestions. Sorry, I forgot, it's my turn. We welcome suggestions, material, tips, reviews, or rants and feedback, both positive and negative. So please do get in touch.
Thanks also to our network of community mirrors listed on the website.
I can't help noticing, Alan, that you deliberately changed around who said what so that you didn't have to read out the IRC.
He did. He was a bit faster. Now, remember, we do actually read all of your emails, but we don't necessarily have time to read them all out. But thank you very much.
And we have 153 people in the group on Facebook.
Oh, well spotted.
And we'll see...
153? It went up by one in 2 weeks.
153,000...
No, just 153. Oh. But we have just hit 1,000 people on Twitter.
Wow.
That's it for this time. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.